This is CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com on a Tuesday. See, I like that song.
Possibility. I'm going to start humming on the show now because clearly y'all aren't really, you know, fans of my singing.
So. No, nobody is really. No,
maybe
no.
My humming will be better.
Nobody really is. look, Pinky's about to kill herself when you sing. She doesn't look like she's having a happy time.
I like Sia singing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Thank you,
we would
Pinky.
Like to send you to the doctor to have your ears checked after the show.
For supporting great talent.
Oh, God. All right. So, listen, lots of things to get to, but I do want to hear, and I'm sure you do too, the experience of Leanne Moll at the traffic department. Now, you went to renew your driver's license.
I made an appointment.
Uh-huh. Because you've online. Got to do that online. You can't just pitch up. They don't take walk-ins.
Well, you'll soon find out that they do. But made my appointment online, and it turned out that you can't just go anywhere. It shows you how it's like a parking lot where it shows you how many parkings are available.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's like. So I was forced to go to Langlachter, which is just
where is that?
It's just sort of southwest of the CBD.
Oof, rapey.
Yeah, no, it's not.
That's not what the Langlachter Tourism Committee want to hear.
Yeah.
Firstly, you've had to go through all of the putting together of paperwork and getting proof of address and certified copies of IDs and filling in the forms and, as Sia would say, having photographs taken, looking at your ugly mug. And you get harassed by people as soon as you arrive saying, do you want photos? All of this sort of thing. It's quite a stressful situation.
Mm-hmm.
Park, go in. Start the process. Everything's going smoothly. I get into the queue, those queues at Snake, where you sit on chairs and you do thigh exercises, moving from chair to chair.
Thigh exercises. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm in the eye test chair.
Oh, yes?
And thinking nothing of it because
is
I know...
Is it gross, by the way? Is it like a dirty, ugly old chair that's threadbare? And
yes.
Looks like it's been neglected most of its life. And,
yeah. You have to... put your forehead against this strip, which I didn't enjoy. But anyway, I'm not panicking. I'm wearing my glasses, which I drive with anyway.
Sure.
Can't do anything without them. And I'm always confident of 20/20 vision with glasses on because mm-hmm. that's what they're for.
Yeah.
So no
and you
stress.
Can do this test with your glasses on.
Yes.
Yeah, of course. Okay.
So sit down, put my head against the machine. But there are lots of these machines and people being tested next to me. On either side. And she quickly points to this joystick. So I don't know if you can remember doing this test.
Yeah.
It's like you have to put your face in this contraption.
Yeah, it's like a pair of binoculars.
Yes, yes.
And then whichever way the E is facing,
yes.
It's just the letter E. You've got a left, right, or up, down on the joystick. Right. Or if you see lights... on the sides of you, you indicate that you've seen them as
where
well.
Where it's happening, so they can tell how good your distance judgment and your ability to see things is.
So it comes up on. Firstly, I put my head on the machine and I don't see anything. So I take my head out. She goes, "Don't take your head out of the machine."
Oh, shit.
Every time you do that, the sensor stops, and then you've got to start the test again.
Oh,
yeah. I said, "Okay, sorry." So put
my She's shouting at you.
Head back in, and the. I suddenly realized that I haven't looked at the instructions properly.
Why?
On which E faces where and where you've got to push. And my mind goes blank. I don't know. My logic just disappeared from my head. So you can see these tiny E's. They are really, really tiny.
Yeah, eventually they get so small you can't see them.
Yeah. And you've got to indicate which way they're facing. And I start doing it the opposite way to which... they're facing.
Leanne.
So it wasn't a sight thing. It was a coordination
thing.
Oh, no.
So, and then I couldn't see the lights because, and this has happened to me before, if you wear glasses, the lights actually are blocked by the arms of your glasses.
Oh, my God.
So you've got to turn your head, tilt your head left and right like a little bird or a
and
puppy.
Still keep your forehead on the sensor.
Yes.
Oh, goodness.
Anyway, she goes, pull your head out. So I pull my head out. She says, you need to start the test again. Don't just press the joystick whichever way you like. So I'm like, I'm not.
Did this person have patience to deal with you at this point? No. Mm, I gather.
Put my hair back in, then I've got problems with the stick. Oh, gosh. Anyway, I failed the test 3 times.
No, okay, so wait.
You have to go home.
Like, no. The first time was because you didn't know where,
second
which
time,
direction to
I was
go.
Still battling with the concept.
And then the third time?
Third time, she clearly said, this is your last chance. And I was nervous, so I fucked up there again.
Yeah, it's just a left or right.
And then, you're a disaster.
She eventually said to me, I'm going to have to send you to an optometrist. But she was really scolding me. So I eventually got it right.
Like, you're such a disaster.
I was so embarrassed. Everyone was finishing their tests next to me and getting up and moving along.
You were taking up everyone's time.
As a person who has general anxiety about everything, but more specifically, I have more anxiety when I'm driving, I'm kind of glad at least our processes are quite stringent and strict when it comes to who they allow on the roads. If you failed 3 times and she scolded you, I'm kind of glad, bro.
Because if you can't figure out
your left to your right,
I'm usually very intelligent.
Okay, but now
and logical.
Yes, I can attest to that.
So I don't know what was going on.
You're an embarrassment. You're a disaster. You're a walking disaster.
Oh my word!
But you eventually got it.
Yeah, eventually. I think she just felt sorry for me.
So, ladies and gentlemen, this hazard of the road, Leanne Moll, who can't tell which way the E's facing, is now going to be on the road with you.
Yes,
driving a hugely heavy ton of metal.
Mm.
At every one of us. This is great news. Well done, traffic department. You've absolutely.
I blame the test. I think it should not be which way the E faces. You don't need to know when you're driving which way the E's facing.
Uh oh.
In my world, an E faces one way.
Yeah, you know what, Leanne? I think you're a problem.
Here come illegal
U-turns. You need to own this.
How will she merge into traffic on ramp to the freeway?
No, you see, I do all of that perfectly. I blame the test.
So I'm a big fan of Google Earth. I'm on it all the time. And Leanne says that they've actually discovered that Google Earth accidentally revealed a whole lot of secret military sites.
Oh.
Well, now this is the thing, because when Google Earth first started, I remember you specifically.
Oh my God, I spent
hours. Oh my word, you loved it. And you were even picking up sites.
Oh, I can find them all.
So this is what my question to you, is this anything new then?
No, I can't imagine there are any on that list that I haven't already seen.
Well, apparently
there's a couple of hidden US military bunkers and sites and secret locations across the state. I mean, I found Camp David before they'd labeled it.
Well, there you
go. Which is supposedly hidden away in the woods. Mount Weather, where they evacuate people to in case there's a nuclear attack.
Evacuate whom?
The president, those kind of people, yeah. Oh, I'm fascinated by this stuff. But I looked that up, 10 years ago?
Yes. So this new article says Google Earth has offered a glimpse of missiles and launches in excruciating detail.
Tell me more.
So the first one that's come up here is that some of Taiwan's most sensitive military sites have been revealed through the update only now, which included a new three-dimensional rendition of New Taipei, Taoyuan, and Taichung. So a military base, which is reportedly a facility for Patriot missiles, is crystal clear. Hmm. No blurring has been implemented to prevent the public from viewing the site at leisure.
Yeah.
It's possible to see the exact location, military base layout, including building structures, and the locations of the missile launches.
That's exciting.
I'll show you a pic, but it's like really very clear. You could work out the meters between...
That's fantastic.
Where you wanted to walk in order to attack.
All right, I like this. This is exciting. I'm going to go look for it on Google Earth after the show.
Taiwan's National Security Bureau and the Military Intelligence Bureau have also become visible on these new maps. So the Taiwanese Defense Minister, Yen Tefa, has said that a task force has been created to work with Google in the interests of national security. They'll be asked to blur the sites, but late for that. While the military will be working on improving the camouflage facilities on the ground. So obviously putting up, I guess, those old school nettings with the leaves and
that sort of thing. What they used to do, I remember in the early days of Google Earth, it might not have been 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago when they'd really started to get those detailed aerial view pictures of any place in the world. The only place that was blurred in the US, because even you can get into like the really close up sort of well-defined high-definition pictures of the White House and Congress and all of that stuff. The one thing that they had blurred out was, at that stage, Dick Cheney's house.
Oh.
The vice president's house in Navy Circle.
Okay.
Ooh.
So you wouldn't be able to plot exactly where you would.
But it's interesting, like George W. Bush, who was president at the time, his house you could see. Couldn't see Dick Cheney.
So what does that tell us?
Dick Cheney was more important than George W. Bush.
That is fascinating.
But it was pretty interesting.
Well, maybe George Bush just forgot to sign the form that he needed to that would blur out his house.
Yeah, probably.
I'm not going to fill in this form.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah.
So. I went through a big Google Earth phase when I was fascinated with Scientology.
Oh, yeah?
And, you know, because Scientology has tons and tons of money. And I often, in my big fascination, was wondering where the money went. And part of where a huge chunk of the money goes are their different properties around the world, but particularly all across the United States. So part of what Scientologists believe is the fact that the main guy who started the religion, L. Ron Hubbard, is going to come back one day. So he's dead.
I wonder where they got that idea from.
Yeah, they believe.
Which religion did they steal that stuff from?
By the way, this is a guy who lived on a ship with kids and made the kids forget about their parents and rather refer to him as their father.
Yeah, anyway, very creepy human being.
So they all believe that one day he's going to come back. And in order to prepare for him to come back, they need to build different houses for him. Because who knows, he might pop up on the east coast of the state.
Oh,
or maybe the west coast of the state. Or maybe in Florida. So there are literally mansions.
Like not in another country.
Oh no, there
God
are
forbid.
Mansions
grown adults,
galore.
Grown adults believe this. I mean, L. Ron Hubbard pretty much wrote down in his own hand once that if you want to make really serious money, start a religion. And he did.
Mm-hmm.
And people are still, oh no, but he knew stuff that, you know, only he could have known.
So I'm not saying waste your time with this, but really I think it's a fascinating rabbit hole to get stuck in. Just go into Google Earth and find all of these Scientology properties. There are hardly modest. They're built on these massive pieces of land, and they're all built for L. Ron Hubbard once he comes back one day. And then also part of what Scientologists believe is that their word and the scriptures that they believe in are so pivotal to humankind progressing that they should never, ever, ever get ruined. So they also have a property with different, and you can see this on Google Earth as well, with different homes and little factories where they are consistently working towards making their word indestructible. So they're working on printing their scriptures on different sheets of metal that can survive nuclear attacks. I kid you not.
They obviously don't know about the sun engulfing the earth.
They've braced for everything. Like if there were to be massive floods, there are materials that will withstand that. And if there were to be nuclear attacks, their word would be able to withstand that. I find it interesting. And
to protect like some science fiction writers. Bullshit ideas.
Oh, yeah, it's
and
their
his
word.
Second coming.
Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, I suppose, you know what? If it blows people's hair back, makes them feel better, go for it.
Hey, Google Earth works.
It's crazy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's mad. Mad. So I suppose what we've learned from all of this is that Sia and I have both spent an inordinate amount of time on Google Earth.
Yeah.
Looking at property.
Yes.
I obviously don't think big enough. I look at my own house and my neighborhood.
Is that all you've looked at?
All places where I used to live and my old school.
When I do a trip overseas, I've checked out everything on Google Earth before I go. Well, now that it's available, I used to love maps. When I was a kid, I used to just look
too.
At
I
maps
would read
nonstop.
An atlas.
Oh, it was my favorite thing.
Yeah.
Oh, I love
maps. I had an enormous atlas book that I used to go to bed with.
Okay, never mind. Never got into that.
All
that's
right.
Not my vibe.
Or a dictionary. That was my second choice.
So is it basically just Taiwan that's in trouble here?
That's what they're saying. That's what's been released now. But they do reflect on previous incidents that are similar.
Okay.
They say in August, the Pentagon banned U.S. military personnel on active duty from using devices and applications which utilize GPS. So they stopped them from using fitness trackers, mobile apps, obviously fearing that could present enemies with information on military operations. And in the same year, that was 2018, last year, two U.S. military training Android mobile applications were found to contain severe vulnerabilities, which would have placed personnel at risk should the apps have entered live combat scenarios.
Sure. Very exciting.
So when they say turn off your phone, it's not like in the cinema. You really need to turn everything off.
Okay, very good.
That's scary.
Yeah, scary, but at the same time, useful information. And now you can get this kind of info if you just have a computer.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on? We talk about computers. Apple have not done anything interesting in the longest time, and there's huge pressure on that company to go somewhere exciting and to do something new.
Yeah.
My sister got a new phone the other day, and it's supposed to be an upgrade on mine, and I honestly don't think it's any better than mine, but there's nothing that immediately sticks out. Like maybe it's a bit faster a processor or something that's under the skin.
It doesn't always seem that way. No. But
what's going to happen here? Where are we going with these phones?
Well, the latest news is that there's a rumor that Apple is going to launch a ton of new gear this year. And apparently some of it's been on our wish lists for a long, long time.
Yes.
There's an Apple analyst, Ming-Chi Kuo, who's known for his accurate predictions. He's laid out Apple's hardware plans for the year in a huge note via Mac Rumors. And they include a fresh size for the MacBook Pro, new iPads, and a huge lustworthy new monitor.
Now, that sounds good.
Does it?
Well, it's not the best thing ever, but it sounds better than what we've been given the last couple of times. Tell me more.
So apparently Apple plans to launch a MacBook Pro with a 16-inch to 16.5-inch display.
Ooh.
With an all-new design.
Okay, is that exciting?
Well, he doesn't offer any other details, but with that screen size, it's likely to sit above the company's laptop lineup. You know, the 17-inch Pro was discontinued in 2012, and Apple's often been criticized for turning its MacBook Pro into a laptop aimed at the general populace instead of professionals.
Yes.
So perhaps this new larger variant will be the Pro's Pro with top specs and, fingers crossed, more ports, because that's another thing that professionals battle with in particular are the amount of ports that your laptop has.
Yeah. I got a new laptop the other day and it's got those USB-C ones. This is probably boring for a lot of people, but it doesn't take USBs.
Oh, dear.
So I had to buy a thing that connects to that connects to USB. It's a bit cumbersome.
Yeah.
And they say ultimately you're going to end up only using these USB-Cs, because people say that's the best port you can have.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it all out.
Also, professionals have been battling with the 13-inch Pro, which is the one that I've got, in terms of space. So they might look at a 32 gig option.
Okay. 32 gigs, it's not a lot.
Sorry.
Because they've got 100 and something gigs.
No, so I don't understand that one. Sorry.
Okay.
I don't.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Basically. Not there. No. Right. Okay. And then quite a few new other devices, which will be coming out as well. Apparently a new ceramic case for the Apple Watch.
Yeah.
So some new accessories.
All right.
As well as an iPod Touch with an upgraded processor.
Yeah.
There's something we have heard about, the AirPower wireless charging mat that apparently should be coming out in the first half of this year. It's apparently really exciting for Apple fans.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. Let's see. Here's Nancy Pelosi talking about how angry she is with Donald Trump about declaring a national emergency to build the wall. This is funny because Nancy Pelosi is, you know, she's got like dentures and
pearls and crochet necklines.
Well, no, she sounds cross, but she's got this lisp because of the dentures. It's just bad. I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm being unkind, but
But it's important to note that when the president declares this emergency, first of all, it's not an emergency. What's happening at the border? It's a humanitarian challenge to us. The president has tried to sell a bill of goods to American people. But putting that aside, just in terms of the president making an end run around Congress, here he said, let us respect what the committee will do, and then walks away from it. We will review our options. We'll be prepared to respond appropriately to it. I know the Republicans have some unease about it, no matter what they say, because if the president can declare an emergency on something that he has created as an emergency, an illusion.
Does she sound like someone in an old age home that's just doesn't have anyone to talk to?
She makes more sense than the minister from our own country that we
played
earlier.
Minister of Sports and Recreation.
Yeah.
Does she? I think they're about on a par, if you ask me. Oh, yeah. I think they both make about as much sense as each other.
Actually, on the other side of the scale, I was thinking, because Nancy's 78 years old, and I know we do tend to get into a conversation around how we should have younger political leaders. What I do slightly admire about politics sometimes is the fact that there is no... not glass ceiling, but no limit per se to when you can be in office or out of office.
Yeah, you can run.
I like the fact that, you know,
you
Nancy's 78 and Ruth is 84. And to a certain extent, if you still can do the job, go right ahead.
I know you just call her Ruth, but who we're talking about is Ruth,
Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I love her. Ruth is my friend. Yeah. I saw her last week at tea.
Yeah. Just one name.
Ruth.
So dentures aside, I think Nancy, if you can still do the job, go ahead.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I think that you should be allowed to become a representative in this country or in America or any other free country at any age. If you've got something to give. I mean, how old is Bernie Sanders? He's in his 80s.
Mm-hmm. Ask his arms.
Doddering old fool, that guy. He's allowed to carry on doing what he's doing.
He's 77.
77? What did you say?
And I always do feel he screams because his hearing is bad now. That's why he screams all over the place.
The 1% of the 1% of the 2% of the 10%. These people have too much money. We should take it away from them.
Hey, Nancy Pelosi is a good 78, though.
No, she's not bad looking. I mean, 50, yeah, a woman in her late 70s, she's not doing too badly. I'll give her that credit.
Mm.
And she deserves it. But she does sound like she's a little bit senile. That's a mental thing. It's not a physical thing. She sounds a bit senile. I mean, I don't think that's too much to say. Yeah, it is. You know, you get a good 78 and you get a bad 78.
Yes. Oh my gosh!
I'm not willing to say anything because we never know which one we're going to be.
But like she and Bernie are year apart. I didn't think about that. No ways.
Well, Donald's in his 70s, isn't he?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean he's not so bad.
He is 72.
Yeah. Okay. So he's a spring chicken compared to them.
I don't know. Is there much difference between
72
and 77?
There's a huge difference.
Yes. Yes, there is.
There's a lot of difference.
Bernie and Donald.
Yeah, they're 8 years apart. No, six years apart.
Oh, Gareth Metz has never been a strong point. Right. Just putting it out there.
All right. Sure.
Stick to history.
Well, here's a young guy who's running for president. His name is Beto O'Rourke. His real name is Richard Francis O'Rourke, but he's trying to sound like he's Beto, B-E-T-O.
Oh, Beto.
Beto O'Rourke. He's interviewed by Oprah about running for president. Listen to this.
I have been thinking about running for president.
Oprah, where does Oprah find these people? Oprah, why do you have these people sitting there? Why? Why can't you interview someone the way 60 Minutes does? Oprah's a good interviewer.
Well, put them in a soundproof room.
Why does she have these people follow her around and scream whenever anyone answers or asks a question? Why do we need them? Who are these studio audience people who are always there when Oprah's there?
That was hilarious.
Do they follow her around?
Or is it a machine that they just...
Well, I'm thinking of running for president. Who gets that excited? Have you ever been that excited when someone said to you, I'm thinking of running for president? Do you... screaming and knocking on furniture and standing up on your feet. What the hell's wrong with people?
Uh,
Can't hear you over your stupid audience, Oprah.
And what's the conclusion? Are you running?
So, this question about...
Listen to those people.
Yes.
Shut up. You're not answering the question for him. Oprah asked him, douchebag. Shut up and sit down. Who are you? You were pulled off the street to be in some show that you didn't even know... You probably didn't even know what show they were going to be on.
So what is this guy's claim to fame?
He ran for Texas governor and lost. But he's one of the Democratic hopefuls because he's young and he's exciting.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a businessman and he's represented Texas's 16th congressional district for 3 terms.
Right. So it's screaming Texans who are doing this thing.
Yeah.
Whether I can be that person to play that role.
Yes.
Not just to help bring the country together at a moment that it is as divided as I can remember in my 46 years. But can we together...
He's 46 and they're talking about him like he's young. I suppose compared to those 3 that we spoke about just now, that is young. 46, huh? Okay.
That is young. I mean...
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
This country together around the big things that we know we should be able to do. So that's a big...
He doesn't want to answer it, huh?
No.
Oprah's like, come on, dude.
Well, he's under a lot of pressure. I mean, Oprah's nodding her head and saying, yes.
And all the crowd are going, yes.
Goodness me.
There must be tough.
So that's a big question for us to think through. And you can tell, I'm so excited at the prospect of being able to play that role. I want to make sure that Amy and I...
It's not playing a role, you idiot. You're doing a job. You want
it's
to
not
run
role-playing.
Do you want to run for the job or not? I mean, it sounds to me like he's made his mind up, but he's just really uncomfortable with saying it.
And who's Amy now? His wife.
Must be his wife. And this is one of those chicks screaming in the crowd.
No, it is.
At the prospect of being able to play that role, I want to make sure that Amy and I, Ulysses, Molly, and Henry, our 3 kiddos who are 12, 10, and 8.
His son is called Ulysses. What a thing to do to your child.
He calls him kiddos?
Oh, Jesus. Is he from Australia?
Ulysses is 12 years old. Ulysses sounds like he should be 155 years old. The last person to be called Ulysses was Ulysses S. Grant, the president.
Oh, maybe,
well, that's why he did it.
Maybe that's a nod.
All right. It's a very good southern name, I suppose.
That we're all good with this, that we're all on the same page, that we go in eyes wide open about what this would mean. And so
shortly.
Even Oprah's losing her mind now. She's like, would you please just answer my question? Just say you're going to run.
Open about what this would mean. And so
shortly. What's it going to take for you to say, yes, I'm doing it? No, and I mean that seriously. What's it going to take for you to say, which I think is a monumental decision,
right?
To say, yes, I believe I am the guy to take that on?
You know, for me, it will really be family.
Amy,
where are you?
I don't know if this guy has balls
Amy
big enough.
So it'll be family.
When we decided to run for Senate, I really mean this. We decided together. We came to the same conclusion, and we knew that at a time that we were considering building a 2,000-mile wall with the lowest levels of northbound apprehensions in our lifetime, we were considering banning.
What a long-winded answer! Just yes, I'm running, or no, I'm not.
Yeah, I would have preferred a yes, we can.
Poor Oprah Winfrey. She's come out of retirement to interview guys like this. Waste her time.
I'm hoping that his hesitation in answering this is that he understands that it's a mammoth task to be the president.
The
I'm hoping that's it. I'm hoping he's not trying to drum up some drama. Won't he? And speculation and interest in him. Because we don't need, we just need someone who's going to take the job seriously.
But also, you've mentioned the fact that you have your family involved in this and your wife, and it's an important decision.
Indeed.
We only need to hear that once to understand.
Yeah, well, I'm not that excited. Just listening to this, I think Beto O'Rourke can, go and do something else for the next 10 years.
Grow some balls.
Yeah, I think go and get yourself some balls, dude. No one's really
stop
that excited.
Stop letting your wife choose your outfit.
Okay.
Make some decisions.
Well, we're going to decide on, well, it depends on family. I mean, everything's so complicated. My kiddo Ulysses. Do me a favor. Say yes or no.
All right, there's still Kamala Harris.
Really?
Have fun with Kamala Harris.
Yeah, well, isn't Michelle Obama running?
I don't think she will.
I haven't heard that.
I think it's just a rumor mill again.
Well, it's an interesting rumor, right? Wouldn't that be exciting?
If
Michelle Obama ran.
Yeah, it really would be.
I think a lot of people would be interested if that happened.
So then the Bush, Clinton.
Obama, Trump.
Then Melania's going to run in 2020.
Oh, God help us all.
Yes, I run for president because I speak a good thing.
Shame, I mustn't knock her on that. She can't, though, because she's not born in America. You have to be born in America.
Even if you're an American...
Born
if you eventually,
in the USA!
Okay, yeah. Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, you can't.
Even if you eventually become an American citizen.
Arnold Schwarzenegger can never be president.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Neither can you, Sia.
Damn it.
Neither can Beto O'Rourke.
My 2032 plans are down the drain now.
Beto O'Rourke can't run because he can't make up his goddamn mind. CliffCentral.com. So MTV have got this new show on, which is called MTV Sugar Down South. And they tackle some hard-hitting issues like HIV, self-testing, PrEP, sexual identity, physical abuse. And I thought it would be fun to talk to the actors who are from that show, Lerato Alaza and Annelisa Pewa. And they're going to join us on cliffcentral.com in the next couple of seconds to talk about what they're up to. The season is particularly important as it is launching around the same time as government's new self-testing campaign, an innovation as a self-testing kit can be taken and done at home. You don't have to go to a clinic. A lot of people want to do that, right?
Yeah, it's much better.
Because let's say you are nervous and worried and you're particularly keen to keep it quiet. It's nobody else's business.
Well, the whole idea is that you should have a counselor present.
Yeah, in case you get the result you're not expecting and then you need to be kind of talked down from, you know, a lot of people get very anxious, very nervous, very concerned about these things. So, you can go and test yourself at home. HIV statistics among the age 18 to 25 age group have shot up. The new season deals with breaking the ice around the subject, as well as self-testing and the misconceptions around it. It's part of a three-year partnership together with the with UnitAid and the MTV Staying Alive Foundation and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine to introduce and evaluate storylines on HIV innovation, including HIV self-testing and preventative drugs in this award-winning drama series. So, Lerato, Annelisa, nice to meet you guys. How are you? How are things going? Grab a seat. Make sure you're comfortable. You ready?
Yes, thank you.
Good stuff. How's the show going? Have you wrapped it all, right?
Yes, we're done.
You recorded this ages ago.
Yes, we're done. We're actually premiering today.
Yes. Very good. Congratulations. That's very exciting. But you've done it already, so it's kind of annoying to have to talk about something that you've already wrapped. I mean, it feels like an age ago. When did you wrap that up?
On the 5th of December.
Okay.
But it's not much of a hassle. I think it's always nice as actors to always review and go back to what you've done. And,
sure.
And review everything that you've done. Try to find a way that you think you could have done something better.
But also, I mean, it's something you've obviously put a lot of work into. You're proud of it. You wouldn't have done it if you weren't good because they would have found someone who was going to do it better. Mm-hmm. So you guys are obviously the best of the best. So yeah, own
I like
it.
The sound of that, yeah.
Own it, absolutely. All right, so tell me a little bit about the show. So those of us who don't, I haven't watched TV for 4 years, so I actually don't know what the hell's going on. So tell me about this show, as if I'm a complete outsider, which I am.
MTV Sugar is basically a campaign that is aimed at educating the youth about sexual health, about decisions that they take up with their bodies. We tackle real-life issues such as HIV and AIDS, self-testing, PrEP, which is also known as pre-exposure prophylactic, which you can take if you are a negative person, you feel that you've been exposed to unsafe sex.
Oh, really?
We also tackle issues such as teenage pregnancy, toxic masculinity in relationships, and so forth. So we're basically trying to educate the the youth and for them to be aware of what's happening around them. And
jeez, young people in this country have a lot to deal with. Huh?
A lot.
Yeah, it's hard. Do you think it's a particularly difficult thing for South African youth to deal with all this really complex stuff, or do you think it's a global thing?
I think you got teenagers all over the world, so sexuality is a thing that sort of starts out during puberty. It's just that different countries have different problems and exposure to different things. So our problem in the country is that we have a huge teen pregnancy sort of dilemma or epidemic, whichever way you want to look at it. So shows like Sugar help us sort of target those areas and sort of recontextualize the situation for us and how we can deal with it necessarily, you know, like down south, specifically for South Africa versus Kenya, which is Kenya and Cote d'Ivoire and all of those things. But it's the same campaign for the same sort of age group, you know.
So your character, Andile, right?
Yes.
Businessman and pretty chilled, cool, calm and collected. But then you get involved romantically.
Yes.
With Lerato's character, Zamo.
Yes.
And then things start getting a little bit messy, right?
Yes.
How does it go? Because this is also the kind of story that many South African families and many people who are falling in love all over South Africa have to deal with.
Mm.
Turns out that there's a family already.
Mm.
So explain the story.
Okay. The way I like to sort of explain Andile is I say that he's what every sort of little boy looks to. I want to be like that. So he's successful. I often joke that he's good looking, he's successful. He's got all the things, you know, he's got a house and he's the picture of success, which is really, really nice. But he also portrays the idea of the single gentleman, as it were.
But he's not.
No. So he's
lying son of a bitch. He's got a family. He's got a wife. He's got kids.
Yeah.
Really slimy.
So what I like to say is that he glitters, but not everything that glitters is gold. And yeah. I suppose that's my teaching component to the story. That's how I fit into this thing. And that here comes this knight in shining armor to save and to dazzle. And this is a situation. It's sort of that sort of blesser ideology, you know. And it's happening all the time where a man will present all these options for women, and you think that you're special, you're loved, you're taken care of, you are in this amazing situation, things are changing for you, and then you get bitterly disappointed. And I think that's the thing we're highlighting with that.
Well, I think it's interesting that in the story that unfolds, Zamo doesn't tolerate that stuff, and she actually walks away.
Mm. Yeah, but like he said, that he comes into Zamo's life when Zamo thinks that a lot of things are about to change for her. Because in first season, Zamo was the most irresponsible parent you could ever imagine. She'd leave her child to go party.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't care. She neglected her child. But in this season, you get to see a lot of growth. You get to see her trying to better herself and better her relationship with her son. And so when she's trying to be a businesswoman and she thinks that there's this gentleman, this knight in shining armor who's here to help her become the better person she thinks she can be, it becomes a completely different situation. And I think with that, we're trying to show independency in a woman and independency in you as an individual before you can rely on someone else.
Now, I can tell that someone's gone to a lot of trouble to script this and to make the story sensible.
Mm. Mm.
But do you also feel there's pressure for you to be educational? I mean, like, there's a part of this that has to do with contraception, that has to do with testing, that has all of this stuff involved. Does it sometimes feel like you're almost making one of those, what would you call them? Almost like self-help videos. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, there's a very fine line. Clearly, the story is good, and the characters are well thought through and fleshed out. But it also, you have to talk about contraception. I mean, people don't. That's the problem maybe in society, is that we don't actually talk about this stuff like you guys do in the show.
I don't think it's pressure. I think if you take the initiative to not educate per se, but In our society, it is so difficult for us to even mention the word sex. It's so difficult for us to sit down and have these conversations. And what we're trying to do is break those barriers so that we can be able to know or make the right decisions of whatever it is that you want to do. If you want to have sex, if you want to be in a relationship with somebody, at least you know when you step in with the knowledge that you need, especially as a teenager, because we go through such adolescence, we go through so many hypes that you can't even talk to your mom about certain things, but then MTV Sugar can help you understand
what's going on. A lot of people, they don't have parents they can ask, parents who they would want to ask, because maybe their relationship with their parents isn't so great, or it's complicated, or there's an authority thing going on, or whatever it might be. So people have to learn somehow, and better that they learn from an entertaining, interesting, inspiring show than that they get it from
the streets and any random person who's also trying to figure out what's going on. So I don't think it's much of pressure.
But it doesn't feel to you like you're doing a public service announcement.
No. I think it's educating and also doing what you love, acting, so might as well.
Look, I've got a slightly different take on that. One of two things. The first was that you've got a Pan-African script that's sort of adapted to fit more specific
regions.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there was a component that I did that was very teachy. Excuse me. It was very teachy, but it was also necessary. So what I find that it's taking things that are out there that don't necessarily make sense in our everyday lives, and we're normalizing them. You're saying, well, they're talking about it on that show. And so we're getting to see people talking about it. So we're breaking the silence, as it were. First, it's weird. It's like, oh, that's weird. Contraception. Who talks about that? Yeah. What is? And then it starts the conversation. But on the second part of it, for me, I found that when you watch shows like Grey's Anatomy, when they're speaking the jargon, you're like, these are actors. Mm. But they sell the knowledge of what they're talking about so much that you think that's inspiring, that's cool, and you approach it that way.
It drops the wall. You start thinking they are doctors.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
Mm-hmm. So we'll start thinking that you are your characters,
which is
in the show.
Which is cool, but also scary.
Thank you. Associated with your
character. So I mean, what areas do you think aren't covered? Because there's always going to be stuff that gets left out. You can't do everything in a show like this. Mm. And there are obviously still some big issues in society, and there are things that young people are dealing with at the moment. You cover a lot of them, but what are the areas that maybe still need to be covered?
Maybe the development. I think any topic in terms of the topics that we have has its own vastness. So like season two, we're touching more on the LGBTQ community. We're touching on toxic masculinity. We're starting these conversations, and you're having different representations of what it means to be toxic. Because my character, for example, is toxic in a really gentle manner. He smiles the whole time.
So he's not this hardcore, violent man. Exactly. Which is what you usually think.
He's not your typical picture that you are used to. You know what I mean? So we're exposing different things.
He's just a liar.
Exactly. Yeah. Right? Conniving. Lying by omission, lying by...
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's trying to play the wife and at the same time trying to get Zamo involved.
Yep.
But there's also a control element that we don't necessarily speak about, because as men we are very empowered, but we're not necessarily aware that we're empowered. And only when that power is challenged do we then start to think, what are we talking about here? And what I mean about that is sometimes we feel that we are justified to have certain things, to behave in certain manners, but those manners are oppressive, you know. I wonder if I should go into examples or whether I'm clear.
Well, I don't really understand that, because I don't think you can be empowered and still be an oppressor. Like, I don't think you're fully empowered if you're oppressing people. I don't know that that's a fair assessment, but I do get what you mean, that men sort of take their power for granted. And in many situations, abuse that power.
Mm.
But I wouldn't call that empowerment. I almost think empowerment has to have a positive spin.
Yes, I suppose maybe swap it for privilege.
Yeah, I don't believe in that either. I think that we live in the best possible time for women in all of human history.
Sure.
And I think that women have an equal opportunity to men in almost every situation. In fact, you could argue in many places that women are in the real privileged position, because there are more women at university than there are men women do less dangerous jobs. Women don't work at night like men do in most professions. They don't work extra hours to the degree that men do. All those kinds of things. They don't go to war like men do.
Sure.
To the numbers in the numbers that men do. So all of this stuff is worth discussing. And often when people talk about privilege, they just assume from a very small group of hyper successful men that those guys determine everything for the whole of society.
Yeah,
do you think that's fair?
I hear what you're saying, and I don't know how much time we have to converse, but I'm very open to it. The idea for me that I'm coming from is like a societal thing where relationships are not equal. So culturally, for example, there are things that are expected of my sister that are not expected of me. Even today, archaic things that are just passed on. It's the norm. Yeah. My sister is expected to do certain things, sure. So much so that my mom will say, this is what we do in our family, you know? So you got gender stereotypes, and when a woman is walking past in the road, you know, whether I say anything or not, I expect her to greet because it's a respectful thing. But we've sort of started blurring lines that, okay, she hasn't said anything to me, so I'm going to say something. And that sort of goes from a hello to catcalling to it progresses. And I mean, when going back to the conversation, the question you had said was, is there anything we've left out?
Yeah. So these are areas we could explore still.
Right. There's space for it because, I mean, there's a lot of conversation, give and take. There's no one real right
answer.
So
have we got a season 3 in the works? Have you guys heard anything yet?
We don't know as yet, but we know that the next season is going to Cote d'Ivoire.
Okay.
I think they got commissioned for India as well.
Very wow. Good.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is cool. I really hope there is a season 3
I
in
hope
this.
So too.
And I'm sure that everybody's excited, but you be sure to watch the brand new season of MTV Sugar Down South 2 as it's premiered tonight. Is that correct?
Yes, tonight 9:30 every Tuesday.
MTV based DSTV nine, yeah. Channel 322. And on Wednesday the 13th, that can't be right because that was last week already, on MTV-based channel 322, that's at 21 hours 30. Make sure you don't miss it. Central African time.
Yes.
Because we've got to give that where it's a continental thing. All right, beautifully done, guys. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Lerato Annalisa, thank you very much for coming to speak to us this morning. I wish you all the best of luck with season 2 of this show. And hopefully we'll be talking to you again soon for season 3.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you
very
for
nice.
Us.
And keep up the good work. It's not just a show. It's not just entertainment. It's not just you being great actors. It's also helping people who are struggling with these situations in their lives and struggling with how to deal with them and who to talk to about them and where to get the real information. So you're doing really good work there. Mm-hmm. Terrific. Thank you both so much. It is time for Blind History, episode 2. Today, we take to the story of a very well-known South African and
me?
Someone. No, not you,
Sir. Okay,
another Zulu.
Zulu. You do feature very briefly in the story. Funnily enough, you don't feature where you think you'll feature.
Ah.
Shaka Kasazangakwa now was Africa's first imperialist. I know that word sounds poisonous, but he really was. Before Shaka, there were tribes. After Shaka, there was a kingdom. And in this episode, we trace the story of the warrior, the madman, and the leader, because he was all three and he was a whole lot more. The soil of our country is stained with the blood of his conquests, and the province of KwaZulu-Natal is decorated with the glories of his achievements. You might love him, you might hate him, but by the end of this episode, you will not be able to ignore him. It's brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters. That's Blind History on CliffCentral.com. It's 1799, Mtonjaneni, Zululand. A young boy, tall for his age, otherwise unremarkable, aggressively fights for his place. His place in a tribe, his place in a future kingdom, and his place in history. He and his mother have never felt that they belonged. They've been on the run, cast out, left to their own devices and treated like strangers by their own families. But he will have his revenge. He will start an empire. Shaka Kasazangakwa is going to change the world.
I'm a real history nerd. I read history books all the time. I watch period pieces and dramas. I love imagining going back in time. In fact, that's what my dreams are made of. And it's very rare to find someone who has the same bizarre obsession. And I found such a person in Anthony Medera, who is the CEO of Taylor Blinds. We decided in 2018 we were going to get together the following year, and we were going to put together a series of history podcasts on the lesser-known side of the people that you might have heard of, the great characters of history. That is what these podcasts are all about. We're focusing on a local, what would you call him, a titan, Shaka Zulu, as many European sources quote him, Shaka Kasezangakhona. Sezangakhona was his father. He was the founder of the Zulu Empire and a person who's had such a long-lasting influence in South African history that to this day, the language is known as Zulu, the place is known as KwaZulu-Natal, and his near relative, King Goodwill Zwelithini, still sits on the throne.
Yeah, it's an incredible story.
I don't know how much anybody really has studied Shaka, but we studied him in primary school because I went to primary school in Natal, and it was a very, I thought, fascinating part of the history that we got to study because we didn't really pay much attention to local history, and when we did, it was the Voortrekkers or it was Jan van Riebeeck, and I thought that Shaka was fascinating because we went off to this place in primary school called Pezulu, which was this village that they'd built to show what a homestead would have looked like at the time of Shaka. And they had weapons that were forged during the time of Shaka, and they had displays there and people in traditional dress. And I just found this fascinating as a child. So I started reading about him. And he's absolutely, indisputably one of the most interesting people in South African history. I mean, he's pretty crazy, and he did some things which I think a lot of people would regard as being fairly brutal. But then history is brutal.
Correct. What drew me to Shaka was I also spent quite a bit of time in Natal. Actually, I did the shark nets way back, and I know those rivers so well. So when you talk about it, when you read the stories about the Tugela and some of the stories that come up because you'll have to travel, we look at Empangeni. Mm-hmm. So Empangeni is a significant town in Natal now, but the name. So panga means to grab, and that came from the crocodiles grabbing the people. So, I mean, that who knew? And at the same time as well, he named a Mamzantoti.
Yeah.
So sweet or tasty sweet water. Yeah. So those type of things, I suppose, because we're in South Africa and we grew up there. So that's big attraction for us.
Well, it's living history. And Shaka's empire was centered in his capital was Bulawayo, which was eventually chosen as the name for a city in what was Rhodesia and became Zimbabwe. And it's quite interesting that the Zulu influence on South Africa is so profound that it is considered our largest indigenous language group. But the Zulus weren't always the most powerful tribe in the area. In fact, the Zulus were an inferior tribe of the Mtetwas. The Mtetwas were the most powerful family in KwaZulu-Natal for a very long time. And Shaka's father, Sezangakhona, was a vassal of the Mtetwa clan. But there was a lot of stuff in his history which is worth remarking on him. He's born illegitimate. His mother, Nandi, had a profound influence on him, and we'll get to what he started doing when she died. When he lost her, his whole world fell apart.
She was an extremely strong character,
yeah,
to such an extent that his father kicked her out.
Mm-hmm. So we have a history of strong women,
yeah,
and women who are rebellious. He's credited with a number of military innovations, which we'll also talk about in a second. But he also forged alliances and absorbed tribes and exerted diplomatic pressure. He conducted a few strategic assassinations here and there where they needed to be done. And his reign very controversially coincided with the start of what they call the Mfecane, which of course is the upheaval that led to huge depopulation in various parts of KZN from about 1815 to about 1840. So the Zulus, eventually a small tribe, the Zulus, managed to take advantage of the defeat of the Mtetwas and the power vacuum that created. And Shaka was by then old enough to himself be cunning enough, smart enough, streetwise enough to take control of that power vacuum and fill it with his own influence. And this is why we talk about the great people of history and why he's certainly among them. He had an enemy early on in the beginning, a guy called Zwide. And Zwide was the chief of the Ndwandwes. And Shaka had such a problem with this guy that he chased him down, defeated him in two separate battles. And when he found his mother, Zwide's mother, he, first of all, she was a Sangoma. They referred to her in Zulu history as an umtagati, an evil Sangoma. When they found her, they locked her in her house and they put hyenas and jackals in the house with her, closed her up in there. When the jackals and hyenas had killed her, they burnt the house to the ground. So vengeful was Shaka after Zwide had thwarted him twice in battle. So he was not incapable of cruelty, and that was just the beginning of his cruelty.
But if we look as well, when you refer to the breaking up, that specific period in history in southeastern Africa, it can't necessarily all be laid on Shaka, because the big part was the lack of grazing. So there were a lot of tribes, and the actual grazing grounds was very, very important for them. And to such an extent that prior to this, they would have almost ceremonial battles. So the king, he would sit under a tree and drink beer, and the two tribes would fight, and they would throw the assegais, and then when it landed, the other tribe would throw it back. And then when maybe the one tribe got tired or felt a little bit overpowered, they would turn around and retreat. And as long as they dropped the assegais, then they would be spared. That was how they settled disputes or land as required for their cattle.
Amazing.
But what happened was, especially with Ding Swayo, him and his mother joined later on, it became more important and more aggressive because of the necessity and the lack of land. So it became more and more important. And then that's where he also came to the fore, because he was a thinking man as well, in that when he saw the way they were fighting, he just said, this is stupid. You know, throwing an assegai, you know, that's a very, very ineffectual way. And that's where he would use the assegai in the beginning to stab.
Yeah.
And then
he shortened it. He turned it into something that they called the ikloa.
Correct. But during battles, he started developing the shorter one. And that just transformed, if you can imagine how it just suddenly transformed. These guys were tossing these these spears and harmlessly falling. Next minute, you get this army that's rushing at you and stabbing you. That was unheard of.
He also developed much bigger shields, and the color of the hide on your shield was your division. So he organized an army. He developed the bullhorn formation, which, of course, was, I mean, various historians have given him credit for that, where you would have the majority of your infantry in the middle, and then you'd have two wings that would spread around the enemy on the outside and encircle them effectively. And then you could go in with your spears, stab them, crush them, kill them, and then take their land, which, as you've detailed already, would then be used for grazing.
But Alexander the Great, I read, also used to use outside.
Like a pincer movement.
Yeah, and so I think there's a debate about it, but if you think about the amount of access he had almost zero access to historical battles. So do we assume that he developed this all on his own?
Yeah.
So the sword and this buffalo horn movement was developed completely. That's incredible.
But it just shows you how great military tactics can develop in two separate places without the two having any communication. And it takes a great leader to make it happen. So he was also the first guy really to encounter the Europeans in that part of South Africa. And he was also the first person to grant permission to the Europeans to enter Zulu territory. In fact, Henry Francis Finn was one of the people who had access to Shaka and treated him medically when he had an assassination attempt on his life. And Henry Francis Finn was also the guy who established communications for the first time between the Zulu and the white people who'd settled in Port Natal, which Shaka had given them as a gift. He'd said, yes, you can settle in Port Natal. If it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have a Durban, which I think is quite interesting.
That is incredible, yeah.
Yeah. He was, of course, murdered himself in 1828 by his brothers, Dingaan and Nhlangana. But we'll talk about that in a second. I want to talk first about Nandi, who you've already mentioned was such a strong woman. And she was very influential, and she advised him throughout his reign. And then she died in, I think, 1827, a year before him. And that was really the end for him. He was devastated. He ordered that for a year, people were to be in mourning. All they would do all year, if he was in the area, was cry. They were not allowed to plant crops. They were not allowed to drink milk, which was the main staple diet at that point. If you became pregnant, you were killed, your child was killed, and your husband was killed.
Sure. Wow.
They say 7,000 people were executed just for not being mournful enough during that time, and some of them in the most brutal ways, being impaled on sticks, kind of in a sitting position. You imagine how awkward and awful and uncomfortable and painful and terrible that would be. And cows were slaughtered just at random so that their calves would know how it felt to not have a mother, because Shaka was so devastated to not have his mother. I mean, this is a psychologist's dream in terms of trying to figure out a sort of an Oedipus complex.
Just referring to Nandi, and I think that's what drove him his whole life, was excommunicated or just cast aside out of tribe after tribe after tribe, finally settling to Dingswayo's tribe, and then being ridiculed by everybody. His name, the Shaka, it was a certain, not disease, but an illness that you get in your stomach. What happened was his father said that Nandi had this condition, and that's why she looked pregnant. And he told her clan, the Lenganis, this is what happened. The elder said, look, you take yourself and your Shaka back to your tribe. So that's
where his name comes from.
That's where his name comes from. It was very, very hard for him. And I think that if you look at when he started to overcome tribes, he started to build the Zulu nation, he still remembered all those people that had wronged him and his mom, and he destroyed them. So he was driven constantly by that. I think that his savior, I suppose, was that physically he was an incredible, he was over 6'3", rock hard muscle, and an incredible fighter. And I think that when he started getting into his teens, that ridicule stopped and that bullying stopped, because he was such a powerful guy. Nobody wanted to fight him. They used to have the play fights with their wooden sticks, and he was very aggressive in those fights.
Well, he was described by his enemies in much less flattering terms, but you've got to take that with a pinch of salt because they were his enemies. So I'm going to quote from something that Finn wrote down. Shaka's enemies described him as ugly in some respects. He had a big nose, according to Balega of the Kwabe, as told by her father. He also had two prominent front teeth. Her father also told Balega that Shaka spoke as though his tongue was too big for his mouth. So a lot of people said that he had a speech impediment. There is an anecdote that Shaka joked with one of his friends, Magai, that he could not kill him because he would be laughed at. Supposedly, if he killed Magai, it would appear to be out of jealousy, because Magai was so handsome and Shaka himself was ugly with a protruding forehead. But this is obviously what his enemies used to say. His friends and those who knew better would shut up and say nice things.
Exactly.
Shaka was murdered, stabbed in his capital by his two brothers, half-brothers in fact, and Dingaan went on to be king after him, but his body was dumped in a grain pit, and they're not exactly sure where he was buried either. But in Stanger, there is a monument to him on what's purported to be his grave. A historian called David Morris is somewhat less convinced and reckons that Shaka's body is actually buried under Cooper Street in Stanger. So we're never really going to know where the body of the first Zulu emperor lies. But as we said, his influence continues to the present day. King Shaka Airport, Ushaka Marine World, loads of other places that are named in his honor.
And also Dingaan, I don't know if it's if it's true or not, but it was mentioned that Shaka said to him, the swallows are going to finally get you, something to that effect. And so Dingaan had this constant fear and hatred of the swallows, which were the whites. So the swallows, because of the way they made their huts, was different. So that was what led Dingaan. And there was a famous battle
in San Luana.
That's right, the famous Zulu victory over the British, which was quite important.
But that was after Dingaan, and Dingaan himself had huge trouble with the Voortrekkers and with the whites the English whites in Port Natal. So maybe Shaka's prophecy came true.
Yeah, true.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History, brought to you by Taylor Blinds and Shutters.
This is CliffCentral.com.